prayer then is prayer. It's a way to talk to Jesus, but it's also a way to kind of step into an ongoing conversation between Christ and his church, and to be discipled and transformed, to learn to pray.
This past summer, the Reverend Tish Harrison Warren and Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center, discussed prayer and abundance together on our podcast. During this season of Thanksgiving and considering upon abundance in our lives and in the lives of those we love, we have decided to highlight this past episode. In case you missed its first release, the Reverend Tish Harrison Warren is a priest in the Anglican Church in North America, a former campus minister, and current writer-in-residence at Resurrection South Austin. Matt and Tish talk together about her book, published just this year, titled Prayer in the Night, for those who work or watch or weep. They also discuss Compline, a formal Anglican prayer, and the importance of seeking an abundant life through the act and practice of prayer.
Tish Harrison Warren, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
You know, I ask people about how their faith informs their life and work. And in your case, you put your faith front and center in your life and work by pursuing a career as a priest. What motivated that life track?
So I didn't grow up Anglican. I grew up Southern Baptist, and there were not women that were leaders, that were at least ministry leaders in my church. So I think if you would have told me as a child that I would be an Anglican priest, I would have said, what is that? And then I would have been shocked and probably appalled. I would have been very concerned about my future theology and self. So it was a long journey for sure. I, as a young kid, 13 or 14, really, in prayer and in community, really had a strong sense that I was called to ministry, but had no idea what that could possibly look like as a female, as a young girl in the place that I was in. And so I was just very open, like, Lord, you know, I don't know what this looks like, but I'll go where you want. And I don't know what that means. And, so in my context, and when I was 18 in the Baptist church, you walk the aisle and commit your life to full-time vocational Christian service is what they called it. And, of course it's like part of the altar call, cause that's what Baptists do, right? They get you down the aisle. So I did that. And again, at this point, it was not, I had been praying about this for years and years, and it had been affirmed by lots of leaders and people in my life. So it wasn't this sort of momentous thing. It was just kind of making public what I sort of already knew in community. But lots of people in the church came and said, we're so glad that you committed to ministry. You'll make such a great pastor's wife. And I was like, wait, is that what I just did? Because I wasn't offended. Again, I said, I was open to whatever this looks like, and I didn't know, but it felt like this conundrum. Like, well, how does one become that? There's no application process to be a pastor's wife. How do I find a pastor that wants to marry me? So I really didn't know. And in college was thinking that I would probably be overseas as a missionary. And I didn't know what this would look like. Long story short, I went to seminary. Well, I got married to someone who wasn't a pastor. I went to seminary, and my husband went to seminary with me. He was not planning on being a pastor at the time. He's planning on, he has a PhD in religious history, so he wanted to be a church historian and teach and go the academic route. We, over years and years, and this is a long story, ended up becoming Anglican. First, actually, we were Presbyterian in the PCA, and then we were Anglican. And then I ended up getting ordained after a long, about 10 years of lay ministry in as a campus minister, which was wonderful, and then ended up getting ordained as a priest. And my husband decided to be a pastor somewhere in our first 10 years of marriage. So we actually got ordained together on the same day. But neither of us would have expected that in college. I mean, at all. So it was one of those very surprising, unpredictable things that God does. You know, people of the Spirit, you don't know where they're going or where they're coming. And we, I don't know where we're going or where we're coming often.
You're right. I just read that this morning, John 3, actually, speaking of which. I love that your story begins, at least the way you tell it here, as being, you know, 13, 14, and just being open, right, to God. Like, I feel these promptings. I don't know what it means, but this is what I feel impressed to do. You've written a beautiful book here about prayer, titled Prayer in the Night, subtitled For Those Who Work or Watch or Weep. And I found this book really insightful. It's inspiring, often touching. And you open the book by telling the story about the book's origins. And I wonder if you could recount that story for our listeners.
Sure. So the book was born out of me sort of living through the year 2017 in our family, which was just a hard year. We moved across the country from Austin to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is a lovely town. I should say that because it is a lovely town. But we were far from home. I'm a seventh generation Texan. So we have deep roots here. And moving's hard. I mean, it just is in any situation. So we moved, and then a week later, my father back in Texas suddenly passed away. And so we moved. There was deep grief. I had a plane ticket that I had bought to come back for his birthday, and I ended up using that plane ticket to come speak at his funeral. So I lost my dad, and then we had we were surprised to find out we were pregnant that same month, and we and then 3 weeks later I had a miscarriage, and it ended up having to have surgery in response to that. And then we're pregnant again, had a long, hard pregnancy. And in July of that year, lost our second baby, a son, in the second trimester. So it was pregnancy loss and loneliness and I think some depression and certainly spiritual doubt and struggle, and then grief over my father. So in many ways, this isn't, there's a genre of books about, so the worst thing that's ever happened in your life kind of books, you know, deep, like profound, catastrophic loss of a child, or a spouse early in life, or, abuse or a terminal diagnosis. Those are really good and important books. My year, in many ways, was it was ordinary suffering, and that many of us experience pregnancy loss. One in four people pregnancies end in miscarriage. I think that's true. One in four pregnant women have experienced miscarriage. That's the statistic. So. And, you know, all of us will lose a parent if we live long enough. Many of us have experienced loneliness. So these are not kind of unusual things, but they're painful. And one of the things I say in the book is realizing that many people go through something doesn't actually make it all that much easier for yourself to walk through it. In the midst of this, I struggled to know, what is it? How do I continue in the way of Jesus? How do I connect to God when things feel really dark, when I feel full of doubt, when I have so many questions that I can't find words for? How do I continue to talk to God in the midst of that? So I say that I was a priest that couldn't pray, which is not great for the job. And what in that, in the, this place of real exhaustion and spiritual dimness, I think, and fatigue and sorrow and grief, kind of found my way, was able to finding my way isn't even the right word, but was able to continue to walk in the way of Jesus by receiving prayers from other people and receiving different kinds of prayer than I had relied on in the past when I had more energy and ardent faith. And so that's sort of where the book picks up. I don't know how specific, that's generally where the book picks up. Like the first page actually starts in the emergency room visit with my first miscarriage. And in the middle of that, it was so chaotic. It was such a chaotic scene. I was hemorrhaging, and there were probably 6-7 nurses in and out of the room. And at one moment when there was just one nurse in the room and it got kind of quiet, I said to my husband, like, I need to pray Compline, which is the Anglican nighttime prayer service. And so this was a year later that I began writing the book and thought, what was it that made me reach for that in that moment? I mean, my husband and I certainly pray together often, but I would, you know, just pray silently or even pray with him, but kind of extemporaneously with our own words. So why in that moment did I say in that, which was absolute chaos, why in the chaos of that moment was I like, pull out the Book of Common Prayer, let's pray together. And so that's kind of where the book starts.
It's really, it's a very dramatic way to begin the book. And it also really, I think, says a lot about a really key insight that you share. I mean, I'm early on the book, you say, you know, you write this, I wanted to pray, but couldn't drum up words, right? Like you just said here. And you add from the book, I'm quoting again, I wanted healing, but I needed more than just healing. I needed this moment of crisis to find its place in something greater. The prayers of the church, yes, but more the vast mystery of God, the surety of God's power, the reassurance of God's goodness. And you found that in Compline, you write about in the book. And I come from a religious tradition with a few, but not that many, fixed or received prayers. And most of them take place in ordinances or rituals, like the sacrament or Eucharist, for example, what we call the sacrament. We tend to teach each other how to pray, how to commune with God, seek the Spirit, et cetera, find revelation for our lives and so forth. And all that's valuable. But you make a compelling point for received prayers. I'm quoting you again. When we pray the prayers we've been given by the church, we pray beyond what we can know, believe, or drum up in ourselves. Other people's prayers discipled me, you write. They taught me how to believe again. It's a beautiful observation. Can you comment on that just for a moment?
Yeah. So I absolutely practice and commend kind of traditional evangelical understandings of prayer, which is sort of like us talking to God with words that we come up with, right? Self-expressive and spontaneous and extemporaneous. So I pray like that all the time. We prayed like that before we began this podcast. So this morning I prayed like that. So, I also specifically receive prayer. I mean, the one thing that I have learned and this book points to is that there's just all kinds of practices of prayer, most of which I was not familiar with for the vast majority of my Christian life. So I saw prayer as this sort of one thing. Just kind of talking to God. And so when people would talk about growing in prayer or continuing to learn to pray or all of our life becoming prayer, I sort of thought that meant just pray more often, right? Which is great, but I'm like, there's a limit to that, right? Eventually you have to go to sleep. Eventually you got to get food on the table. Like I have to write and study. And so really what that has meant to me is learning more and more to be open to the presence of God, and to practice different ways of praying, different kinds of varieties of prayer, in order to press into God in different ways and different parts of our life. So receive prayer specifically has been really interesting to me because it is praying. It's not just reading, it's praying, but it's praying in the words that you've received from someone else. And so because of this, when I do this, I end up praying in ways that I would not pray on my own, that I wouldn't get to, that I wouldn't conjure up. That I wouldn't be spiritually mature enough to occur to me to pray in certain kinds of ways. And so prayer then is prayer. It's a way to talk to Jesus, but it's also a way to kind of step into an ongoing conversation between Christ and his church, and to be discipled and transformed, to learn to pray. An analogy I've used is that I have a second grader, and she has been over the past, you know, year and a half, 2 years, learning to read and becoming a better reader. But I had to sit with her for hours and hours and hours and teach her to sound out the words, and she would trip up on them. And she needed someone kind of further in the craft of reading who had read for a long, long, long time to help her into this practice of her own. It's absolutely her own practice, but she learned from me kind of how to do it. And I feel like when I receive the prayers of the church, it feels like my older brothers and sisters in Christ are sitting with me and they're like, "We know you don't know how to pray. And we've been praying for a long, long time." We've been praying these prayers for 2 millennia. Some of it in the prayer book, there's prayers from the 3rd century in there. And we're going to sit with you. And as you trip over your own limitations and myopic narcissism and fears and anxiety, we're going to sort of teach you to pray. And that receive prayer has been that for me. I mean, part of the reason I talk about the sort of vast mystery of God is because one of the reasons I was drawn to Compline specifically, these nighttime prayers, is because they really acknowledge danger, really don't answer all of our questions. It's not a comprehensive reason of why God allows darkness or danger or allows, you know, the perils and dangers of this night, as one of the prayers says. But it also says, "Be our light in the darkness, O Lord," right? And so it just really, without flinching, really acknowledges brokenness and danger and darkness in the world, but calls forth the light of Christ in that. So there's a great mystery to that. They don't pin it down. It's not a systematic theology, but it's an invitation into faith that isn't sort of shiny and chipper and it all works out and everything's good and Jesus makes your life wonderful every moment. And it felt like, man, Christians have been praying these psalms, for instance, through it all, through the death of parents, through their own loss of children, but also through war and plague and famine. and these are the words that have brought them back to God. And so I feel like receive prayer teaches me to pray again, but it also shapes me, like my theology and my life, and opens me up to new ways of thinking in the world. Like I have a chapter in this prayer that the book is framed around. There's a chapter on Shield the Joyous. I don't want to skip too far ahead in the interview or in the book, but I don't think I would have ever considered joyousness as part of vulnerability and as something that needs shielding, unless I would have learned those prayers from someone else. It's now, of course, self-evident, I don't think I would have gotten there on my own. So I feel like I learn from these prayers how to pray. That's the short answer.
Yeah, I thought that these insights of yours in the book and here in conversation, I find them really very insightful, very profound, and I've given me much food for thought, which I've really appreciated. You said so many things there I'd want to pick up on, and I could actually spend several hours with you talking about passages in the book, you know, and
that sounds and fun. Sharing experiences. We should do that sometime.
We really should. Let me ask you something you write about theodicy, right? I thought this was really important, this observation. Theodicy, you know, our grappling with realities of evil and suffering in light of the idea of God's goodness. Something you write in the book, and I'm going to quote you here, is that theodicy is not a cosmic algebra equation where we can simply solve for X. It's almost primordial, a scream, an ache, a protest from the depths of the human heart. And you compare theodicy to, I'll quote you again here, an existential knife fight between the reality of our own quaking vulnerability and our hope for a God who can be trusted. I thought that was a great description. And I guess my question is, in your experience, does that knife fight ever stop? Does it graduate to something gentler like a staring contest? Or does the standoff between suffering and hope remain fraught?
Mm-hmm. I really love this. I have never considered this staring contest analogy, but I love it so much that I might steal it at some point. It's such a beautiful, beautiful image. I love the idea of a staring contest with God. I love that idea. And I don't know the answer, honestly. I think to some extent, there's here's kind of my shot at this. I think these questions of how long, oh Lord, where are you? Why aren't you setting this right? You know, I think part of the idea I got of sort of theodicy not being this kind of answer that we're looking for is because I don't think there's some kind of rational explanation that's going to actually satisfy. If in the middle of this, if I could get a letter that sort of explained to me why all of this was happening to me, I am still not sure I would be satisfied. Because I think in theodicy, in that struggle with what, how can God be good and powerful and bad things still happen in the world? I think there's also a longing for wholeness, a longing for things to be made right. And I don't think any kind of explanation is going to take away that fundamental longing for that things are not as they are meant to be and that we want them to be set right. It's a longing for justice, I think. It's a longing for healing. And justice and healing, of course, rely on explanations, but they don't stop there, right? There's action involved and there's miracle and there's redemption. That's what we're after, I think. So in that sense, I don't think theodicy, I think I will continue to wrestle with these questions. I think when I read the Psalms, man, there's so much of where are you, right? Why have you forsaken me? How long, O Lord? Why did the wicked prosper? Vindicate me, you know, at kind of crying out to God that sort of where are you in the middle of this? And I think that I'll continue, and I resonate with those Psalms. And I think I'll continue to resonate with them till my dying day. I think that theodicy will meet its end when we encounter the person of Jesus himself in glory, you know, coming and setting things right and whole, bringing perfect justice. Like, that is what theodicy is ultimately. I don't think about it as simply a philosophical question, although of course it is that, but I think it is a human yearning for shalom, for Jesus to set things right. So in that sense, I think it will always be there. But of course, I think in our life, these questions grow louder and quieter at different times, right? I would have said in 2017 that I had all my questions answered about theodicy. I could write you I wrote papers on this in seminary, right? Like I could, my sort of philosophical, systematic, pat kind of answers to this, maybe it's unfair to call them pat answers, but kind of rehearsed answers to this were solid. It was just deeply emotionally unsatisfying. So I do think in my own, I'm only speaking for myself here. I'm really talking about my own experience. There have been times that felt the energy and deep struggle of a knife fight. And there have been more times that felt like a staring contest or even, you know, kind of a more of a place of almost exhausted lament, you know, where I'm thinking of when my kids get really, really sick and they just sort of pathetically look at me and say, you know, can I have a popsicle or something? And I just sort of sit with them and am present in the midst of something of pain. And I think sometimes the Odyssey has felt to me like, can you just sit with me in this pain? Can you see me? Can you notice me in the midst of this? So what I'm saying is I do feel like the emotional timber of this changes in different seasons of our life. And I don't just want to say that in the dark times is when this comes roaring back, because actually there's been times where I've experienced suffering where the presence of God has felt much stronger even than when it's just in the sort of day in, day out sorrow and suffering of our life. But I do think pain, suffering, sadness is a regular part of the human life and a regular part of the Christian life. I think maybe even more so the Christian life. I think there are times when it does feel like a knife fight, and there is other times where it feels different than that. But then I'll also say all of this, I'm more talking sometimes by the hour than by the season. I mean, I think we can change within the day of sort of how we're experiencing this. But the basic posture of longing and yearning and looking for light in the darkness, kind of resonating with the Psalms of lament, I think that's just the Christian life. I think that's pretty much the whole thing. So it's not all there is. It's certainly not all there is. There's also, for instance, in the Psalms, celebration and rejoicing. And so I certainly don't want to make it seem like that's all it is. John Piper said, life is war. That's not all it is, but it is always that. And I feel that there always is sort of a sense of struggle against darkness. I mean that in a nonviolent way, but there is a struggle against darkness. And that's not all there is. There can be real, real immense pleasure and beauty and glory and wonder and fun. But then it's always just kind of there. It's always sort of in the background. And one of the things this book draws out is that, gosh, we're just emotionally complex creatures, we humans. And so we can hold a lot of things at the same time.
I think it's to put it mildly, and we better, right? Because there's a lot we have to deal with. You know, something that you said a minute ago, I want to pick up on, that the Christian life is often not an easy life. And I really love what you say about what the Christian perspective under the abundant life means, right? That Christian abundance may not mean material comfort. In fact, that you remark that Christian discipleship often makes life harder in the short term, right? That our convictions can carry us from a life of ease to something much more difficult, much more rigorous, and that Christian flourishing, as you put it, is always a cross and resurrection. Read that line to my wife. She loved it. Christian flourishing is always a cross and resurrection. I'm curious what this means for you in practice. Do you find yourself praying for that unique brand of abundance, or do those prayers terrify you because of their implications?
Both. The answer is yes. I find myself praying for them and they terrify me. This is such a great question. I love this question. And I think for me, gosh, it's just a constant struggle to want to see reality as it is. I mean, the reality is that through the cross is the only way to resurrection, right? The reality is that that to follow Jesus, to live by reality of his kingship in the world, is to take up a cross. And that is somehow a place of deep lament and sorrow and death, but also profound joy and beauty. And so I want to see reality that way. And it's a constant struggle, because that's not the story America tells about reality, right? That's not the story that I've sort of been brought up with in consumer culture, that that the way of abundance is the way of death. And that's not
that wouldn't sell many cars, Tish. No,
no, it's terrible. So I think the answer is I think a lot of my prayer life is to change my heart that I could see the world in according to truth and according to the way God sees the world and God sees reality. So the way this looks practically is when I have an opportunity, let's say I get a job offer or a speaking gig or something that holds a lot of prestige or that pays a lot of money, that I think that there could be a tendency to say like, well, this is obviously good. And for me, I'm sort of like, is it? Cause it could be good. It could be, or it could be temptation, or it could be vainglory, or it could be kind of the way of death, not in a good way, the way of pride. Or it could be good. And so it just takes an enormous amount of prayer and discernment and walking in community and being among people who are needy and are broken and who don't have power, and to kind of reteach us that the way of the world. But I do think to some extent, especially if you are at all a privileged American, which I'm speaking out of somewhat. No, I am. I'm an educated, privileged American. That it's having to sort of relearn that up is down and down is up. It's just this sort of complete reorientation. So I think that a lot of it is terrifying, and but it's not only terrifying, because I actually believe that Jesus loves us and wants to set us free. So I've been around the church and pastoral situations long enough to see the casualties of the pursuit of the abundant life defined outside of Jesus, the casualties of the pursuit of the American dream, or our own kind of pleasure, or our own way, or our even, you know, paths of uncontrolled anger, or and so I know that's not where life goes. But I also think it's just sort of having to constantly relearn what abundant life actually looks like. And so this is part of actually a way that I'm needing to grow as a Christian, is that the actual way of abundance is what is appealing to me, because usually it's false abundance that is appealing to me. And so I have to sort of just kind of constantly in the process of having to have new eyes towards the world.
That's a hard lesson to learn. I think it's a really important lesson to learn. I know that in my case, I feel like over the last few years, I don't think I've ever felt quite as blessed by so many, in so many ways as I have over the last few years, but I've also never quite felt so beset with care, you know? And I think those two things often go together in the Christian life. I work at a university, BYU, and so I'm around people, that, you know, younger people often, and who are going through earlier stages of life. And I was around someone recently who has a difficult decision to make. And I think that in this case, there's probably a pretty clearly, I think, right or better decision, but it's a difficult one. And watching this person grapple with this has not been easy, but it is a lesson in abundance. And it makes you realize, yeah, the lesson itself, it's the same lesson, but the exercises get more difficult.
That's right, is
how I think about this.
Yeah, two things I would say with that. First of all, that's so beautiful. I love what you said about feeling more deeply blessed, but also more beset. I think when Jesus talks about the abundant life, it's abundant joy and abundant sorrow. It's different than a flatlined life, right? Where we just sort of muddle through with our devices and kind of feel nothing and doom scroll. I think that there's an abundance that we are called to that we'll have both. And I also think, just because you're talking about young people, this is my kind of soapbox recently, is that I would love your thoughts. I can't speak to how this is in your community, but I think that a lot of the way that we've discipled and catechized young people coming up really sets them up for failure and unbelief and walking away from the faith, because we spend time telling them, walk in the way of Jesus. Walk in the way of Jesus, and you'll have a marriage that's beautiful, and you'll have so much excitement and adventure, and your life will feel meaningful and important, and you'll change the world, and you'll have joy, and you'll have abundance. We don't define that abundance,
exactly.
And you'll have goodness and beauty and all sort of all of this, and then they do it. They pray, and they you know, hold off sex till marriage, and they do, you know, all the stuff that sort of they feel they're supposed to do. And then things are hard, and things are disappointing, and marriages are struggling, and they get in their first or second or third job and go, this doesn't feel meaningful at all. Or I'm seeing brokenness in my church, and these leaders that I didn't know was there, and this is disappointing. And so they say, there's just disappointment in life. And we have not then equipped them to, so in other words, if we're selling Jesus with false promises, then when those promises don't pan out, people don't go, oh, those promises were what was wrong. They go, oh, this is a lie. This Jesus bit is a lie. And I think it's really harmful. And so Jesus he's constantly promising abundant life. He's constantly promising the kingdom, this glorious, wonderful thing. He's constantly promising God's love and protection. And he's very upfront saying, I'm calling you to a cross. You are going to die. I mean, when you read the Gospels, you just think, oh my goodness, this guy, this is like the worst PR I have ever seen. and it's the horrible evangelism strategy, and it's not going to work, and except that it is our Lord who is making it. And so I think I'm seeing, as we see the rise of the nuns and folks walking away from the faith, it's certainly a lot of reasons for that. And it's not just this. There's all kinds of cultural reasons for that. There's lots of reasons, but I think part of it is that we have to be really honest with people about that the way of Jesus entails a cross, and that disappointment and sorrow is a really normal part of the Christian life. It doesn't mean that it's not true, and it doesn't mean you did it wrong. And we need to equip people, young and old, that when they do experience disillusionment or doubt or sorrow, that they know how to respond to that in ways that are faithful and that are really handed down, because we are not the first generation of young people to notice that there's profound darkness in the world.
I love that, what you say. And I think that lesson is so important to teach, so difficult to learn, you know, especially like in a culture like ours, consumer driven, where what we see all around us are images of pleasure and instant mm-hmm. self-fulfillment, not just gratification, but fulfillment, like fulfillment in 5 minutes. You know, it's it's difficult to reconcile that with the idea of the cross. It reminds me of the story that's told in the Synoptic Gospels about the rich young man who approaches Jesus, right? And, you know, good master, and what must I do to inherit eternal life? You know, and the answer is, well, you know the commandments. And he says, I've done all these things. And and in Mark 10, there's that one line I love, right? That's a little bit different from the stories in Matthew and Luke, where Jesus looks on him and loves him. And then says, right, the thing that, of course, he knew that the young man couldn't do, sell what you have, you know, and take up your cross and follow me, you know, and the young man goes away grieved, sorrowful, because he had great possessions. There's a lesson in there, right, about turning away from the idea that the gospel, the abundant life means prosperity, to the abundant life meaning spiritual closeness to God. These are different kinds of ideas of abundance.
Yeah.
We've got about 5 minutes left. Let me ask you about a couple more passages in this book. This is such a beautiful book, Tish. And as people listening can tell, you've got some really great insights into prayer and kind of the contemplative life. One of the more poignant lines in your book for me was this one. You say, the shape of our prayers determines the shape of our life. And you put that into the context of praying for those who are suffering, right? The implication being that to pray for those who suffer is to involve ourselves more completely in their lives and to work to make their lives better. But that principle, right, that the shape of our prayers determines the shape of our life, seems widely applicable to me, right? To pray fervently for God to help us succeed in something is to risk becoming obsessed with success, right, as a sign of God's favor. Or to pray insistently for answers to spiritual questions is to risk becoming overly consumed by what we don't know, and so on. So for better and worse, prayer shapes us. So my question is, how prayer shapes your life? Do you pray for different things today than you did 5 or 10 years ago? And have these prayers changed you?
Yeah. So I think there's some kind of natural from the gut prayers that I naturally pray that completely speak to my own impulses and desires, exactly like what you were saying. An example of this for me, I've mentioned my kids several times, but I as a mother, I just naturally I pray for my kids a lot because I just sort of naturally long for their flourishing and their wellness and their goodness. But I have noticed that I'm actually wanting to try to find some received prayers, like some other people's prayers for children specifically, because I've noticed it's so easy for me to pray for my kids' happiness, health, success. I do not pray that my kids would like learn to take up a cross. I haven't prayed that. Granted, I mean, they're very little right now. So, especially as they, my daughter turned 11 this week. She's my oldest. I'm realizing, oh, I'm going to have to learn to pray things for them that I would not naturally pray for them. I would naturally pray for her wellness and health and flourishing. And those are not bad prayers, and I need to keep praying them. But maybe faithfulness in prayer for my children is going to involve more than that. And so I really do feel like receiving prayers and specifically the Psalms have been really helpful in sort of shaping prayers that I wouldn't pray. Some examples of this I've used elsewhere, but I used to never, ever pray for political leaders. I know the scriptures say to, but I just was too cynical and would have no idea what to pray and would pray with a fair amount of ire, like help these idiots, right? Like, and so in our Book of Common Prayer, there's prayers for leaders, justice, prayers for justice and peace, and that they would, and specifically like by name, we name political leaders and whoever they are, whether we voted for them or not. And that's been a really helpful exercise for me. Also prayers for my enemies that come from outside of me. I mean, that are received prayers because they tend to be in ways more loving and even or even just dispassionate than my own prayers for my enemies. They tend to stretch me. People that have hurt me, they tend to stretch me so that I pray for people who have hurt me in ways that I wouldn't otherwise. I mean, I can think in some ways, I think the Psalms have made me tougher because the psalmist often is praying things like vindicate me and you know, let me feast on your goodness in the presence of my enemies, right? Like there is this sort of, the psalmist doesn't mind kind of owning people as the kids would say. And I'm not like that and tend to be kind of, more fearful, I think, than that. And so actually, I know that this can be, I need to tread lightly here because in the day of Twitter, this can be used to as a complete excuse for terrible treatment of enemies. That's not what I mean at all. But I just mean, I don't think I would ever pray, God, vindicate me, publicly vindicate me. But I have learned to pray that through, like literally through daily prayers of the Psalms. That this guy was a warrior in a way that I frankly am not. And yet we do have an enemy. Like I mean spiritually speaking, I'm talking about Satan and demons and prince, like the powers and principalities at work in the world and systems of injustice and systems of sexism and racism and brokenness in the world. And so I think again, these prayers sort of push me into praying more passionately for justice and for and to be marked by to be standing with those who sit in the council of the righteous and not those who sit in the council of the wicked, as someone would say. So I think, I think these prayers have sort of toughened me up in ways that maybe I wouldn't have experienced on my own.
You know, I think those prayers are so necessary today. You know, I said this earlier, I don't come from a tradition that has many received prayers, but your book did send me to the Book of Common Prayer to read some of these. I found them very moving, and I found your insights throughout in this really beautiful book, Prayer in the Night, to be profound and instructive. So thank you so much, Tish, for talking with me today. It's been a delight, and best wishes to you in the coming days and all the things that you say about this book and about the things that you write next.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I will say, if anyone is hearing this and thinks, well, I don't know even how to get a Book of Common Prayer and I don't know where to start with this, if on my website, it's completely free. I get nothing from this. You can click on Prayer in the Night, and there's some four different Compline prayers. So if they have no idea, never seen a received prayer in their life, that's a place to kind of go look at a little bit of what we're talking about. So So
great. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Have a great rest of your day. Hopefully talk to you again soon. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Abby Thatcher. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.